You're listening to the Illuminaire podcast, where we dive deep into behavioral health topics and shine a bright light on the forces shaping this industry's future. From research and technology to business and investment and more. Here's your host, Dr. Ronit Molko.
Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Ronit Molko, and thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Illuminaire podcast. Today, we are talking about preparing autistic individuals for adulthood. And I'm absolutely thrilled to welcome my friend and colleague, Mary Ann Kaler. Hi, Mary Ann.
Hi, Ronit. Thank you for having me.
Sure. So, Mary Ann, you have a long resume of achievements in your career as a business leader in marketing, strategy, and innovation, and more. You're also deeply involved in supporting not-for-profit organizations. And in fact, that's how you and I met through our work together at the Autism Society, supporting the community in Los Angeles. And you're also a warrior mom who's had to navigate the system for your own son. And you've also advocated strongly for autistic individuals and individuals with special needs in general in our community. So I'm really excited to have this conversation today. It's such an important topic. As you well know, we have a growing population of autistic adults who need support to navigate adulthood and all the complexities that come with living independently, finding employment, developing close and intimate relationships. And of course, part of the system is the parents, right, who are often struggling with not being able to find the resources they need. And what I hear so much is this extreme worry about what will happen to my child as I get older and when I'm no longer here. So I really am excited to have this conversation and learn from you more on this. Let's start at the beginning in early childhood. After a diagnosis, what is a good approach for the general care team that's going to be supporting this child and family?
Yeah, so I love that question. So first of all, thank you for the introduction. And also, I'll just say this, that my husband, Eddie, and I have an adult son who actually will be turning 25 very shortly. And he's a high support autistic male. And, you know, just it's been quite a journey for 25 years. And so I appreciate so much how you acknowledge sort of the journey that we've been on. But with the greatest of love and respect, I want to just kind of take issue a little bit with the term warrior, because it's thrown around, I think, as a compliment, because I think, you know, you're a mom, I'm a mom. We're kind of fierce supporters of our children, aren't we? But that term has developed some pejorative of context in the sense that I think sometimes what ends up happening is that self-advocates see that as a way of almost like fighting their identity and fighting who they are as opposed to accepting and creating allyship. And what I've come to, and I would say that's accurate, when early on, my son Liam was diagnosed before he turned age two, which at the time, you know, 23 years ago, that was quite an early age to be diagnosed.
Right.
Now I think it's less uncommon, but at that time it was. And I think at that time we were really fighting the disease. And in a way we were fighting who he was, if that makes sense. And over time we got smarter, hopefully as a world, but also we got smarter as parents to understand that our job was not to fight who Liam was, but really to be an ally and how to conspire for his success. So how do we become conspiratorial in making sure that the world who will encounter him as other and different accepts him as not so different?
I appreciate you saying that. And when I thought of that word for you, it was very much in the context of fighting for awareness, acknowledgement, yeah. Acceptance.
Yeah.
You know, but you're right, right? In the beginning, there was a big move, certainly when I started working as a service provider, towards, you know, let's cure these kids, let's change them.
Yeah.
But I think about it very much in just your work, just all the work you've done in conferences and speaking and highlighting self-advocates and bringing their voice to the table around what they need and what works for them.
Yeah, and I thank you for that. And I speak, you know, not instead of Liam, but I speak because I'm very grateful that my husband and I are on the same page and that our job was really to have him be a self-advocate. And he's very, you know, as parents, you know, sometimes, you know, be careful what you you ask for, because he's such a strong self-advocate that he's very much his own person. And as parents, we often, you know, get a lot more pushback than we bargained for. But, you know, it's his life. He's 25, you know. And even though he's a high support adult, he has every right to be 25 and to have his own way. That's the tricky part. But in early childhood, we didn't see it that way. And we really thought that our job was to, I'll say this, most parents upon the diagnosis, it's a feeling of terror. And the terror is the unknown. The terror is, will I be up to the job of being what this child needs? But the terror also is, this is not the life I thought I was going to have. And so my sense is, you know, early childhood, that is normal, that is natural. But my encouragement of, you know, when I talk to folks who are getting a diagnosis, autism or otherwise, is see how quickly you can possibly get to a different mindset, because that will hold you back. And I remember when Liam was younger, we had a great advisor who's still in our life today, Zoe Malo, who is just a brilliant, brilliant expert in sensory integration. And she had said, Marianne, I know so many adults that are autistic. And what I have to tell you is, people just like you and I, we're growing and changing every day. And you feel like there's this time frame in early childhood where you're like, if I don't get it all in immediately, it's, you know, we're doomed. And the truth is, as quickly as you could get to quality of life and thinking about your child with whatever diagnosis it is as a whole person, just like you would a typical child. And Ronit, I'll say this as a mom, my guess is all of my friends who have more than one child will say every child's different. And no child is what you, no child is what you thought right. was going to be when you were pregnant, right? You're like, oh, it's going to be. And then they come out and gosh darn it, they're their own person, you know? So as quickly as you could get to who is this person, and what is the quality of life for their well-being that I can support and be an ally in and conspire for their success? That's my greatest wish for folks.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I think that emphasis on quality of life is something I see in you in everything that you do, kind of how you think about life and probably how you approach business as well.
I think so. And I'll say this, it's because what we know as parents, but particularly for parents whose child may have a disability, is that we really need to think about the physical, mental, and emotional well-being, right? And a lot of times what happens is someone's diagnosed and they say, and we focus often on intellectual capability. Will this person graduate from high school? And there's so much emphasis on academics that oftentimes what happens is the mental and emotional well-being suffers. And I know so many individuals who have a diagnosis of, let's say, autism, who have graduated from college and will come back and say, there was so much emphasis on academics, and I wish there was more emphasis on my emotional and spiritual well-being as an individual. And I feel like now I've got this piece of paper, but there are so many pieces of my life that I don't feel accepted, or I don't feel like I can fully be who I am because I'm supposed to be this, I'm supposed to pass and try to cover as being someone quote unquote typical, right? So I'm supposed to look right. neurotypical, even though I have these other things going on. So it doesn't matter where someone is when we're speaking about autism, where they might be on the spectrum, because every piece of that is an interdependent experience, just like you and I. You know, you and I had technical glitch at the beginning of this call, and so we had to call someone in. We're interdependent on someone else to say, what are we doing wrong, right? That's life.
And I want to, later on in our conversation, I want to talk about services. But one of the things, you know, that Christine, who we both know, said to me that was such a highlight was the whole focus of my therapy was, how do I become independent? But nobody taught me how to become interdependent. And she said, you guys are all interdependent. You need each other. You know when to call on somebody for help. But I was never taught that skill. And I think it's such an important piece, yep. You know, that it's not just all about being independent.
Yeah. And Christine's a dear friend. And, you know, she resembles so many folks that we know who have, you know, multiple degrees. And she's dear friends with my son. And she, you know, Liam did not graduate with a high school diploma. And yet he's been living independently, or shall we say interdependently, since he was 19. And Christine had said, you know, it's interesting. Liam knows how to cook. Liam knows how to do all these beautiful things to care for himself. And we need to do more to balance those things around our, you know, our whole person, right? Just like you and I do, right?
You and I do
the same thing. And I think, you know, that piece of the older I've gotten, the older my husband and I have gotten, the older Liam has gotten, the more that we it sounds silly and it sounds so obvious, but it's like, well, how would you and I want to be treated? Right. How would you and I, you know, want to be raised, or how would you and I want to be treated in the community? And it sounds so obvious, but frankly, that's not how folks with differences are treated. That's not how folks with disabilities are treated when they have some kind of, you know, whether it's communication or physical accessibility need in the community.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, you've had a big influence on me and my thinking, because I've come for many years from the service provider lens, and everything we're taught as clinicians on how to approach this. And you know, when I met you and started working with you, you very deeply informed how to think about this differently and things that I was not thinking about as a provider. And one of the things you've highlighted is this idea of citizenship. So what does citizenship mean? And how is this a big factor in this journey?
Yeah, thank you. So there's someone that you and I knew, and someone who's very dear to my family, by the name of David Sponder. And David was a real pioneer in relationship development intervention, meaning really being person directed in how we approach helping someone who may have a disability. And he introduced the concept of citizenship to Eddie and I, my husband. And he would come to our house, Liam was young, and he would say, so, how is Liam a citizen in your home? And we really couldn't answer that well, you know. And part of what we started to realize was that we were not treating Liam as we would if he were neurotypical. And what I mean by that is there's so much that Liam had to offer within our family, that the concept of self-determination starts with being able to have the dignity of purpose. And so how do we have purpose? How do you have purpose? How do I have purpose, right? So we have our work, we have the ways that we give back in the community, we hopefully are of service in our nonprofit work, et cetera. But we're citizens at home too, right? We share citizenship across the family members. Who does the dishes? Who takes out the trash? Who wipes down the table? Who sets the table? And what we realized is that, you know, David would kind of come into our home and work with us. And he's like, it's constant valet service here with Liam, like Liam's like living, like, you know, like, and what I think happens, and I just want to say this as a caveat, is that no parent sets out to do things to do harm to their child. I don't believe. Maybe there are parents that do, but I don't know any, right? All of us make mistakes with the best of intentions. So it's not about being good or bad, but it's about having an open mind to learn from the things that we're doing. And what we realized is there was a ton that Liam could do. And the more that he was a citizen in our home, the more purpose he had and the more value he started to feel he had. So what were some of those things? You know, he maybe couldn't, you know, we couldn't say, hey, Lee, go down and do your laundry. But if he came down, could he put, at a young age, could he put the clothes in to the washer? Could he take the clothes out and put them in the dryer? You know, and so how do you break down certain things that happen in the household? His job became taking out the trash. He was excellent at it. He loved it. And so there's really a sense of pride. This sounds so obvious, and I'm embarrassed to even say it, because of course this is what we all experience, but there bloomed a sense of pride in him that he started to recognize his importance in the world. And then that has ripples effects as we age. I'm sure you see that with your own kids. So typical kids with, it doesn't matter. My elderly mom, it was the same thing, right? We all need purpose. We all need to feel that we're a citizen in our lives. But those are where the seeds of self-determination start to come from.
I introduced this concept of citizenship to my kids, and I said to them, you know, you show up as a great citizen at school and contribute, you know, you belong to lots of clubs, you take a lot of ownership and accountability for who you are. So let's have a conversation about how we show up as a citizen at home. And we had multiple conversations about what it means to be a good citizen at home, that, you know, within our home, we're a small community, we have to participate and we all contribute to make the system work. I can't say that it was received with a ton of enthusiasm by my teenagers, but, you know, my kids had responsibilities and roles at home and, you know, had to complete those and be part of the system to get the privileges that they wanted. And, you know, now that my son's in college living in a dorm, he's actually commented to me about how he notices the lack of skills and the lack of citizenship in some of his peers. So I think it doesn't just apply to our special needs community. It's so important for everyone.
Yeah, everything you and I are talking about is universal, but we tend to put folks with disabilities in a box as if they're, you know, this bubble, right? Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
So self-determination, I mean, let's just describe that a little bit more for our listeners who may not be familiar.
Yeah, so self-determination is a concept around, you know, giving the individual with the disability the right and the dignity to have a self-directed life, right? And in some instances, it has some very technical and specific meaning in terms of some of the things that we look at in California as far as the law, self-determination, and what it means in terms of funding and things. But in terms of general use, what it really means is, am I living a self-directed life? And this concept is a little bit painful to me in the sense that I find that individuals of all ages with a disability are often treated as forever children. And it varies by disability, perhaps. But in general, I mean, if friends of mine who are in wheelchairs will talk about, you know, people patting them on the head or, you know, I mean, we just have such a long way to go in terms of making sure that we're respecting people equally, regardless of who they are. In the concept of, as you brought it up initially, transition to adulthood, I think having a self-directed life is something that can be established very early on. And some of the things that we did, and I really credit my husband very much as someone who's a really talented actor and director, he had a very clear point of view in terms of communication and respect of Liam in ways that preceded a lot of our being smart in other ways, if that makes sense. It was just sort of like innate in Eddie, and I'm grateful for that. But some things to give you an example would be, right after Liam's diagnosis, Eddie had established a family rule where no one was allowed to talk about Liam in front of Liam as if he weren't there. And you will notice this, that people talk in front of individuals with disabilities as if they're not there. Yeah. We'll talk about them, right? And I would see kids coming out of a occupational therapy session or a speech session, and the therapist would be talking to the parent about the child in front of the child as if they weren't there. Well, you know, that sounds like not a big deal, but if you're constantly treated like you're invisible, how does that impact you in terms of your spirit? So Eddie had said, you know, when Liam's there, he's part of the conversation, even before he had language, right? Even before he had language. And it doesn't matter if you're verbal or nonverbal, you get to have a self-directed life, right? And so other ways of that can be planted early on, Liam has always had a very beautiful sense of direction, north, south, east, west. He knows north, south, east, west. He was born in New York. He came here before he was a year old, but he thinks he's a New Yorker. So he's like, well, if you're a New Yorker, you know north, south, east, west. Nobody in California knows north, south, east, west, right? You're like, so he would be with, you know, coaches or someone, and they'd be driving, and he would say, go east, you know, here, and they'd say, "What's east?" You know, but where's east? He's like, "Turn right. What's wrong with you?" But even as a baby, he had a beautiful sense of direction. So from a very young age, we would give him a self-directed experience by saying, "Hey, we're going to the store to go grocery shopping. Which route would you like to take? You know how to get there. So you direct me. I'm driving. But turn right here, turn left here, turn right there." Now, there may be 20 ways to get to Ralph's, right?
Right.
Grocery shopping. But who does it hurt to let him do that? Now, what happens is it's empowering someone who often is disempowered in his day-to-day life. So what are all the ways that we can give someone power, can give someone a sense of choice in their life where many choices don't feel available to them? Something simple in the home, like, "Hey, we could either have, you know, hamburgers or roasted chicken tonight. What do you feel like? You get to pick." So I think thinking of all the simple ways of providing power and providing self-direction from a very young age. And what happens is, lo and behold, you're raising someone who's a self-advocate that has very strong opinions and recognizes that their voice matters. The caution in that, though, is to be careful not to give a choice where it's a false choice. What do I mean by that? So often what happens, we do this in our everyday life with everybody, but as a parent, to say, "Hey, are you ready to go to bed now?" If it's meant for it's time to go to bed. Because if you ask a question like that and the person says, "No, I'm not ready to go to bed now," and you say, "Well, it's time to go to bed," that's a trick question then,
yeah.
Right? So only ask choices where you're 100% willing to go with what choice is chosen. So those are, you know, those are some really simple ways of, I think, planting seeds from a very young age that establishes the muscle of, "Hey, I matter. I have a voice. I have a choice. I have a point of view."
Yeah. And the data from 2017, I'm not sure if it's updated yet, but 2017 showed that of the group surveyed, 10% of adults were making choices about basic things, where they lived, who their roommate was, what they ate,
yeah,
what activities they did.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, huge need over there.
Lots of room to grow in that. Absolutely. And I think part of that, again, Ronit, you know, it comes down to, as parents, for the best of intentions, we're making mistakes. And one of the biggest mistakes that parents make is they make decisions for their loved one because they feel they know better. Now, maybe they do, but there's something called the dignity of risk, right? And the dignity of risk is that first of all, pick your battles.
Right.
Right. So, you know, hey, pick out what you want to wear today. That might be a risky thing to do, depending on, you know, how Liam would step out and what he chose to wear that day, right? Dignity of risk. How risky is that? Not risky. It's his choice. He
right.
wants to, you know what I'm saying? And so it's like, hey, we have to, yes, but I don't want people laughing at my child because they picked a wacky
right.
outfit. Well, you know what? That's that person's problem. That's not Liam's problem. Liam feels good about, you know, it would never dawn on Liam to be embarrassed about how he looks. He thinks he looks great. And frankly, he looks like Liam. So right. I think how are we allies in conspiring in that individual having dignity about themselves?
So on the parent side, it's developing a tolerance for that discomfort, right? You might be teaching your child how to shave and he might miss a whole bunch of patches. If you keep doing it for him, he doesn't develop that skill. So it's the tolerance of 6 months, he's going to walk around with a partly shaven beard until he masters the skill, right?
You hit it right on the head. And I remember a mom telling me early on, her daughter was washing her own hair and she wouldn't rinse it well, despite mom's, "Hey, you know, you might want to rinse it a little bit." And she had to absolutely bite her tongue because it's like, is it worth me having her not feel good about herself? So she's going to walk around, maybe her hair's a little more limp than I would like it to be, you know, a little fluffier or whatever. But that dignity that we give an individual to be their own person.
Yeah. And in addition to the dignity, which is so important, is those types of independences later in life, right? If you need someone to do things that you can do for yourself, to wash your hair, and that you develop A, more dependence on people, less independence in your choices, but then also more risk in the disability community, because we know that, you know, the rates of abuse and crossing boundaries inappropriately is much higher in a community that perhaps can't speak for themselves or, you know, use the right language. And so just how important that is to develop those skills where you can.
Absolutely. And that's a very real fear, just like all parents have fears of the risks that their loved ones might encounter. That's very real. It's real. I mean, as you said, the numbers of abuse are high for individuals with disabilities and the elderly. And, right. and those are vulnerable folks. But that doesn't mean that we keep people in a bubble. That means that we build the muscle around being a self-advocate, around knowing that their voice matters and making those kinds of decisions that are important to them.
So on this journey, on a transition to adulthood, I mean, share with us a little bit about kind of the early days, how you measure success, milestones, supports. You know, there's so many factors that go into what that looks like. And I think so many parents are struggling with, how do I do this?
Yeah, well, there's so much that goes into that, as you know, Ronit. But, you know, one of the big, so transition to adulthood, I think, you know, a lot of times I've worked with a lot of families and self-advocates on gaining independence. And let's say, for example, living independently or living, let's say, outside the family home, right? So that can involve a lot of interdependent settings, but outside the family home and kind of making one's own way more so than living in the family home. And a lot of times what I'll hear from parents or families is, oh, no, my son or daughter, that they're not interested. They want to stay in the family home. And now, that may or may not be true. Right. That and part of what we have to understand is that, does that individual realize that there's a different option available to them? Number one. And number two, have they been made to believe that a different option is not an acceptable one? So how open has that choice been? I always have to question that and wonder about that, right? And with no malice involved. But I think that if we're planting the seeds to someone that, oh, it would be really scary, or you wouldn't like it, you'll be lonely, or if you're telling someone those kinds of things, of course they're going to say, no, I want to spend, you know, the rest of my life in the family home. Now, there's nothing wrong with staying in the family home. I'm not judging that. But what I am saying is that there's an array of choices that has to be better made for individuals to understand that there's a bigger world available to them. So one of the things that we did for Liam was, starting when he was 14, we started taking him to places around the country for him to see many different kinds of settings and many different kinds of ways that people have made choices to live. And so that, of course, could be the family home, that could be in settings that are very different. And so by the time he was 19, we didn't think that he would want to move out of the family home until he was 21. But he surprised us at age 19. And he was like, I'm ready now. And he made it abundantly clear that he was ready for more independence much sooner than we had planned for, financially and otherwise. So we talked a lot about it with him, and it was very clear that this was very truly his choice and what was important to him. So we made a lot of decisions, and he ended up making a choice that he wanted to live with a roommate. He has 24/7 supported living services, which means he and a roommate lived in their own home, and that folks would come in shifts to support them, not living with them, but would come in and support what they needed to live, you know, safely and support how they wanted to live, right? Ultimately, Liam then made the decision that he didn't want to live with a roommate after a number of years. So now he lives.
Oh, wow.
And there were just too many people, you know, right. His choice, it was like two individuals plus the one-to-one support. So at any given time, there would be four people in the home. It was too much. So he very much loves his lifestyle now. We had to listen to that and adapt to that. It's his right, right? So I think part of what happens is be prepared for learning. One of the earliest things that was told to me was the advice that, you know, becoming an empty nester, and I'm curious, I think other parents of neurotypical kids will say the same. When you anticipate becoming an empty nester, you think that it's going to be much less work for you. And what you discover is, as a parent, it's just different work. Sometimes right. It's harder to be a remote parent than it is to have someone under your roof and be a parent there where you can see what's going on, right? Because, how, as you said before, do I know you're safe? Do I know you have what you need? So there's establishing that rhythm. Just like anyone becoming an empty nester or any individual moving out of the family home, what does that look like, right? How do we establish boundaries? How do we establish communication? But having said that, to realize that there will be learnings on both sides, and that the individual who is transitioning to adulthood, how do we set that person up for success? So there's a lot around understanding what is needed initially for the transition into the new space. And so for us, what that looked like was initially I lived with Liam for the first month before he felt like he, you know, in his space, right? And then his support staff came, started working with him, and his roommate moved it. So we transitioned things based on the steps that we needed. What we found was the thing that I will say about this process was that it became very useful, and I would consider it a best practice, that we had a very strong team approach, as all of the folks who supported Liam in the different aspects of his life were treated as a team, not individual support individuals. And so it helped the communication. It helped for consistency for Liam, so that he had folks that were in his life that had a very clear and consistent understanding of what his needs were, as opposed to each person sort of dropping into his life and having a different way of doing things. And based on how he responds in his environment, consistency tends to be really important. And so how do you cross learn? How do you cross share? How do you establish ways of monitoring what's helpful and not helpful so that others can benefit from that learning as opposed to learning from scratch?
Right. How did you put together that support system? I mean, I think that's where so many parents are struggling. Where do I find the support?
So it's really a complicated process. I won't fib about that. And in Liam's case, he has a team that works with him, which is his Monday through Friday, what we used to call a day program, right? But he has a one-to-one coach that is with him Monday through Friday during, you know, kind of work hours. And that's the coach that works with Liam in his employment coaching, in his day-to-day, you know, when Liam's socializing with his buddies, when he's meeting friends for lunch, pre-pandemic, post-pandemic. So obviously the pandemic world is a whole other thing. And then in addition to that, there's the supported living team, which is outside of those hours that I just described. So folks that would be with Liam in the morning as he's getting ready for his day, folks that would be with Liam in the evening as he's, you know, having his dinner and after dinner and getting ready for bed. And Liam happens to have support during his sleeping hours because he also has some, you know, needs during that time as well. So bringing the two agencies that support that, plus Liam has other services. So all those folks, we kind of bring together in a monthly meeting, and we talk about the goals that Liam has. Liam obviously is driving that meeting, which he learned from leading IEP meetings. That was a goal that was established in middle school, was for Liam to not only participate in his IEP meetings, but by the time he was in high school, that he would be leading them. And that seemed like a far-flung goal that was unachievable. But lo and behold, by the time he was in high school, he was in fact leading IEP meetings and learned to be very vocal in the ways that he was giving feedback as to what was important to him. Now, keep in mind, Liam's a high support individual. He has communication limitations. So lest folks assume that he is what people like to call high functioning or someone who has, Liam does not have that, but we have given him ways to make sure that his voice, that we listen very loudly to what he has to say, and that's our responsibility. Might take longer, it might go slower, and it might take a lot of preparation, but that we're invested in that process because his input to that is really important. So those team meetings would resemble Ronit, not terribly dissimilar to those IEP meetings that would be team-wide where Liam's leading it, and Liam's preferences and goals and Liam's desires for his quality of life are the things that we're talking about. And his dad and I become one of the team members. We're not leading, right? We're not the one that's in charge. He's the one that's in charge. And we make it really clear, not in a way that's insulting, but the folks that work with Liam, they're his staff. They work for Liam. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, for him to be respected in that way, which is, I think, really important.
That's just incredible. I absolutely love that. I did not know that he was leading his own IEP meetings. And what it made me think of is, you know, so often, maybe less now, but certainly 20 years ago, when parents received a diagnosis, what I heard a lot from parents was the doctor said, he'll never graduate college, he'll never get married, he'll never live alone. Like it was just sealed. And I think that can really limit what possibilities parents think are out there because they're kind of given this sentence on day one. And then if you have team members, as you say, that are constantly talking about the person in front of the person in the third person, it just kind of shrinks that possibility. So I think those are such amazing awarenesses. How did you manage your goals and your expectations, both from the parent side and from Liam's side, on how this process kind of unraveled?
So I won't fib to you on this. So every team needs that person who pushes the expectations. And I will say, with no insult intended, it's rarely going to be the parents. And what do I mean by that? The parents will want the best for their child or their loved one, right? But to have someone who's for using the example of Liam's IEP, right? So, you know, David Sponder had said to us, you know, Liam needs to be in IEP and all this stuff. And we're like, I'm not seeing it. What happens is, though, it's not that it's not achievable. It's just that it might take a long time. So one of the IEP goals was that Liam would do this. So it was actually an IEP goal for him to participate and ultimately lead his IEP. Interesting, right? And so he may have started in October working on the things that he needed to work on for that end of year IEP, if that makes sense. It may have taken him 8 or 9 months of practice.
Preparation, right?
So Liam would do things like he would interview his classmates and the teachers and other professionals in the school and say, give me feedback. What, you know, how do you think I'm doing? Or what do you think about, you know, ways that I could be more successful? So that created a mechanism for him to understand his relationship to other people. And then he would also give input as to, here's what's important to me. Here's what I think I can do. And he eventually started to develop a PowerPoint that would be given and presented at the year-end IEP that would talk about those things that were important to him, feedback he got, you know, throughout the school. So it started to shape his understanding of his place in the school. Similar to that, we had set a goal. It had been suggested that Liam could take on this role of managing the inventory for his school, meaning paper goods and pens and paper towels and all of the purchasing. So like a purchasing manager, if you will, within the school. And it just seemed like a wild, crazy goal, a crazy expectation. And so I got to the point where I would just kind of smile and say, okay, you know, I have to confess it's a horrible mom, but like, I was like, I don't see it happening, but you break it down. Right. And so what ended up happening was slowly but surely over the course of time, Liam actually maintained an Excel spreadsheet and learned how to assess how much inventory was in the school, how much was needed. He would actually call around and get price check, the best price for, hey, paper towels, how much does it cost?
Wow.
Martin Final, how much does it cost here? He would go make the purchases and come back. And then ultimately, he had this additional job that he loved within the school, which was they would go to the farmer's market once a week. And so he would go around to everyone in the school and take orders for who wanted what at the farmer's market. He would maintain a spreadsheet of, you know, Ronit wants, you know, a bag of carrots and a bouquet of roses, and she gave me $20. So he would track all that, go to the farmer's market, make the purchases, come back, give everyone their goods, and determine how much change they needed from the farmer's market. So you can imagine how useful those skills are once he ended up into his own home and went grocery shopping. And now he's a whiz at what's my inventory? What do I need to go shopping for? You know, how do I develop a recipe? What is my, you know, what does my meal plan look for? Like, so all of these kinds of skills that you start building at a very young age that seem far flung, that seem like, you know, and to assume, you know, presume competence. You and I hear that term all the time, presume competence.
Right.
And it goes back to that early concept that you and I talked about, which was, you know, talking about the person as if they're not there, you know, to assume that the individual is able to make their own decisions and to presume competence. So regardless of what the, you and I know, so many folks with all kinds of different disabilities who have certain challenges, right, and certain limitations, who are absolutely capable of making decisions for themselves,
right,
whether they're verbal or nonverbal, whether they, you know, whatever it is, right? And so someone would look at that individual and presume that they're not. And you and I know better because we've met so many people who've been underestimated in their lives, and lo and behold, they're fully capable of these amazing capabilities and ideas and dreams for themselves. So after knowing enough folks like that, you and I lose the idea that that's not possible. We're like, of course it's possible, you know, right, but we need more people to understand that in the world, don't we?
Yeah, you got to break the learning down into small steps.
Yes.
Okay, so in the context of services, we talked about this a while back, but you know, there's a very large applied behavior analysis community. I know that you have talked openly about, you know, where that kind of falls short and where RDI was so important. Can you speak to that a little bit? Because I think it's really important for, you know, I'm starting to hear more and more from providers, oh, we're starting to think more about the long-term impact of our services and we're starting to think more about outcomes. But there is a shortfall in the programming that's done on really looking at this child as the adult they're going to become. You know, it's kind of, I think because funding is limited, although now it's expanding, but for a long time was limited to those very early years, we weren't really given the opportunity or the space to kind of say, okay, there's a path here. This is a long journey of building skills for adulthood. So what would you say to the ABA community and what, you know, what needs to be added? What's missing and what's working?
Well, you're the expert on this. And so I'm a little embarrassed to even answer this question because you know this from top to bottom, but I'll give the feedback that I'm aware of and that I have experienced is self-advocates, adults, individuals with disabilities that have participated in ABA will tell you. So forget what you and I think, right? The folks who've been through that. So many adults will say it was trauma inducing for them. And there's a lot of work that you and I are aware of and you and I have done through Autism Society in the LA community, where we've gotten the feedback around the importance of mental health and the concerns of trauma. And so within our own family, without revealing, you know, personal details, trauma the impact of trauma in the disability community has become something that unfortunately I had to become very knowledgeable about. And that includes, very often we hear about the trauma of caregivers and family members who have had difficulties of balancing caregiving with other aspects of their life. Having cared for an elderly mom, I can say that, you know, all of those things that we do as individuals to juggle all of those pieces in our lives are difficult. You know, they're just very difficult. But too infrequently, we focus on the trauma that individuals with disabilities themselves have encountered by being marginalized, minimized, and underestimated throughout their lives and excluded, right? So there's all of these ways that individuals with disabilities have just not been able to be seen as full human beings. And that has created a lot of trauma for individuals. So keeping that in mind, going back to your original question around ABA, I think currently ABA has evolved what I'll say is very good ABA providers take the concept of measurable outcomes and incorporate that with many different modes that are person-directed. And the traditional, original concept of ABA was very trauma-inducing. I mean, you're basically, you know, doing harm to someone in the old days, right, when we talk about aversives. And you're basically rewarding someone for doing what you want them to do, which in itself is the opposite of self-determination. If you do what I want you to do, I'll give you a reward. And part of what that does is if that is not done the right way, it strips a person of their autonomy. It strips a person of their ability to make decisions and trust and be confident in their ability to make decisions and choices. And on a different note, I was just on a conference recently with an individual who told a story of he had been a stutterer as a child. He grew up not in the U.S., in a different country. And he was sent to this program where every time he stuttered, he was beaten. And so he learned not to stutter because he didn't want to be beaten. Okay. And I'm not saying that's what ABA is, but my point is there are approaches that were used in the past that have to be looked at and have to be recognized for the damage that they do. And so I know, you know, so many folks who are experts in ABA are very, very dear friends of mine, and I cherish them. And the reality is that the use of how we support people has to be person-directed, and it has to take the whole person into account and not just the action or the behavior, right? It has to be, how am I helping you as a whole person?
I love that. Thank you. That's very insightful. And I mean, you know, I think that's what I'm hearing more and more of. We're seeing more providers, you know, move to a much more what we call contemporary ABA, you know, much more modernized, certainly not using the aversives that we used in the past and really looking at the larger picture and the person. What about, you know, now in adulthood, we're seeing so much of the need for and the desire for much more interpersonal relationships, intimacy, sexuality. I'm sure you've encountered this in, you know, in your work with Liam and with others, but what comments do you have? What can you share about that?
I think it's an area that's so important, and I really appreciate you bringing it up, Ronit, because I think it's talked about too infrequently. I also see that there are too little in the way of resources and information made available to individuals with disabilities in terms of having access to understand their own bodies, understand what that means. You know, so I think the obvious answer is that education and information is critical. Self-determination and self-directed lives is critical which means that I need to be able to, you know, sexuality is not something that if you have a disability, you don't have a sexual need, right? I mean, that's part of us being human beings, right? And so again, no different. However, I think that it goes back to that original comment about people being forever children. And a lot of times we want to consider someone who may have an intellectual disability or a physical disability as not being adults. And of course they are. And so how do we do that in a way that is respectful and dignified? And I think it's an area I'm really glad you brought it up, because I'm going to give more thought to it now also about how we can make a difference. But we just have to be doing much, much more in terms of making sure that people have access. And, you know, it came up recently, some folks were, you know, asking me, you know, do you think Liam will ever marry? And I asked Liam, and he said he wasn't sure. But I would be very, very surprised if Liam didn't end up having a life partner. He's just, you know, he has so much to give, and he's a great man. And I'd be disappointed if he didn't find himself in a situation where he had relationships ongoing in that way. Right now he's single, but you know, anything's possible, and I'm hopeful for just his joy, whatever that is.
One last question, because you know this podcast very much addresses behavioral health, business, all areas, and you've got this incredible business career. How has your role as a business leader informed your work in the special needs community, and how has your work in the special needs community informed how you lead in business?
Yeah, well, thank you for that. So the disability community is, you know, like anything else, right? It breaks into business and nonprofit work. And so you and I being involved in both of those areas, I think as someone who's an advocate and an activist in the disability rights community, it helps me because I apply what I know as a business person to the ways that I can help both businesses that serve our community as well as nonprofits. The other piece is, as a parent, very early on, there was so much I didn't know and that I had to learn about autism and having a child with a disability, and frankly, just having a child, right? Liam was my first child, and I was learning just being a mom. But in this case, in terms of being an activist or an advocate on his behalf, being an ally on his behalf, I had the business skills that I could apply to it. So what did I know? I knew how to research. I knew how to create teams. I knew how to monitor progress. I knew how to develop strategies. I knew how to develop a business plan. And so like life plans, like any of us, right? I'm a list maker, I'm a planner. And so, you know, how do you develop strategies? How do you measure? Are we making progress? Are we doing the things that matter? But also learning, you know, as you and I have to do as business people, is teaming, communication. How do all of those things fit into having a successful outcome. And I think also learning that to be innovative means making mistakes. And so not to be afraid of mistakes, right? To learn that, oh, that didn't work. So what might we do differently? And to know that there's not just one way, to question the norm. And I would say also to feel empowered to challenge the authority of people who perhaps knew more than I did, but maybe, you know, there were things that they didn't know, and to have the confidence, I think it gave me confidence to be able to persevere.
I think that's really, I mean, I love those connections that you made between your skills as a businesswoman and how those applied. I think those are so important. Also, as you say, challenging professionals, I think professionals often make the mistake of coming from the point of view of I'm an expert, so I know better. But you know your child, and you know your family, and you know your values, and you know your dreams and what can be possible. And so it's the two together. You know, as you said, the professional's pushing you to consider things that you may think that's not going to happen, and you pushing the professional to understand that I know my child, you know, better than you do, and these are things you need to consider. I think that balance is so important.
And I think also what you learn is when you're in the business world and you're a supposed expert yourself in something, is that everyone's human. And that means, I think there's no exalted,
authority.
Authority in this situation is we're all learning. We're all just doing the best we can. And we're all learning from each other, right? And hopefully we make each other better by sharing that information.
Well, thank you, Marianne. This has been just exceptional. And, you know, I learn so much from you all the time. I so appreciate you and what you do. And I think parents and providers out there are going to learn so much from this. I really, really am grateful for your time.
Well, Roni, thank you. And I just want to say I admire you so much and I'm flattered to be able to share this time with you. And you're really an inspiration in all that you do. So I thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the Illuminaire Podcast with Dr. Ronit Molko. If you like what you heard today, please subscribe, rate, review, and share our show with other listeners. See you next week. Thank you.